Hey, it's Becca.
It's Nancy.
It's Brixie.
And this is
Insane Investigations.
Welcome back.
Welcome back.
Welcome back.
Thank you so much for listening. Today we are going to be doing another solved cold cases episode because that seems to be something that you guys really enjoy. We did pull it from the same book, Solved Cold Cases by Robert Keller. And before we get into it, we just wanted to give you guys a reminder to follow us on Spotify if you haven't already. We do still have a plan to do a giveaway, so get on that,
yeah,
if you haven't already.
We haven't promoted that in a while either, so just a reminder for anyone who, if it's your first time listening or if you've been listening for a while and just haven't followed us on Spotify, make sure you get on that if you want some goodies,
please. So I think we can just get into it now.
So the first solved cold case that we're going to talk about is the case of Dana Fader. So she was a 27 year old mother who lived quite a hard life. So she had three kids, and when her marriage had ended with her husband, her kids unfortunately got separated, which obviously that in itself is just not great at all, and that must have been really, really hard for her as a mother to have to like experience that and go through it. So her ex ended up moving out of state with her oldest daughter Angela, who was only 10 at the time when all this happened.
That's awful.
I know, they were all like, they're all young, like 10 was the oldest. Her middle child, Colby, ended up living with Dana's parents, and she worked two jobs to try and like support, obviously, her child, but even at that, she could still barely afford to get by and pay her bills. And as if that already wasn't kind of hard enough for her financially, like, she also had to be constantly chasing her ex-husband for child support for her youngest son, Johnny. So Johnny lived with Dana in an apartment in Lake Worth, Florida, a residence that she also shared with her brother Joseph Bailey. Luckily, Dana was able to get by with the support system that she had nearby. So her mother and her stepfather lived in the same building, and her sister Martha also lived in the same building, and she also lived like just straight down the hall. So they were able to like help her out with the kids and things like that while she was working her two jobs. So on the evening of June 19th, 1987, Dana was feeling quite low after having a fight with her ex. So her sister Martha suggested, let's go on a girls' night out to try and cheer her up. So that night they went to several bars before Dana eventually called it a night and went back home. Martha dropped her at Willow Lake's apartment complex around 2 a.m. And after dropping her off, Martha decided that, you know, she wanted to still go out and have a few more drinks.
Still
so
in the groove.
Yeah, she was still in the mood to party, so she, you know, went back out. So in the meantime, obviously, Dana went home. A few minutes later, Joseph woke up. So Joseph is her brother. He ended up waking up when he heard the sound of clattering coming from the kitchen. And when he went to the kitchen, he found that Dana was just there making herself sausage and eggs. And, you know, we've all kind of been there.
Been there.
When you get back from a night out, doesn't matter what hour it is, you're hungry. My go-to, I wouldn't be making sausage and eggs now because I can't fuck with oil, but I would be there making myself like an oven pizza or something.
Mine was a bowl of cereal last Friday, and I was literally falling asleep eating the cereal to have a conversation with Alan. That's what happens when I go out partying with the youngsters from work.
Yeah.
My mum found me in my sitting room on the recliner with a plate of sausages, just passed out one morning.
So yeah, we've all been there. Sort of food.
We can relate, definitely. So Dana said to Joseph at the time that she was thinking about going to pay her boyfriend, like her current boyfriend, a visit, who also lived in the same building. So Joseph was like, okay, cool, leave you to that. And he went back to bed. The next morning, Joseph woke up and he smelled burnt food basically in the house. So he went to the kitchen and found that the pan that Dana was using the night before was still on the stove and the sausages were burnt to a crisp. So Joseph ends up searching the apartment for Dana and then realized that she's not there. She's nowhere to be found. The weird thing was that he did find Dana's purse on the kitchen table. So he was like, okay, if she's gone far, you know,
she would have taken it.
Why did she leave her purse there, kind of thing? But she did say she was only going to visit her boyfriend who lived in the same building. So, I mean,
kind of makes sense.
Kind of can see it from both sides. Like, why would she need her purse, you know? Joseph then goes up to Dana's boyfriend's apartment to obviously see maybe she spent the night there. And when he went knocking around, she wasn't there either. So next he was like, okay, let me go check my mom's house. Maybe she went over to visit my mom during the night or in the early hours of the morning and she could be chilling over there instead.
Because they all live so close.
They're literally all
in the same building.
Literally. So he goes around to his mom's house and Dana wasn't there either. And then that's obviously when they decided to call the police. So deputies arrived at the scene and they began searching around just like the general area. And they found Dana's 1980 Ford Fairmont parked on one side of the complex. So one side of like the apartment building. And the keys were still in the ignition at the time. Dana was found inside the vehicle, still wearing the beige dress that she was wearing the night before. And I'm just going to include a quick trigger warning, maybe skip ahead a minute or two, because we're going to get into quite a graphic description of how her body was found. So her dress was hitched up over her waist and stained with blood and seminal fluid. She was found in the backseat of her car and her legs were spread and her eyes were just staring straight forward. Obviously she was dead, if I haven't said that already. She also had dark bruises all over her throat and it was concluded that she had been raped and murdered.
And clearly just left.
As she was.
She was, literally. Like, no attempt to cover it up whatsoever. So detectives theorized that Dana might have come downstairs to get something from her car and that's when she was ambushed. Now this is kind of what the detectives are theorizing happened, right? This isn't like facts, this is how it played out, this is how they believe it all played out. So once he parked the vehicle, he had hung up a blanket from the back passenger window to help shield the scene of what he was about to do. Yeah, that was when he then attacked Dana, raped her and then strangled her to death because of the bruises on her neck. So the autopsy found scratches and finger imprints on her neck, and it was also found that she had a bite mark on one of her nipples. Even the coroner described this murder as savage and animalistic. So the police started the investigation by actually questioning one of Dana's ex-boyfriends, who already had a history of domestic violence, and then they also questioned her brother as well. All of these suspects were cleared. The investigation ended up running into trouble when the biggest lead they had were palm prints that they discovered on the rear window. Weren't able to identify the murderer. So obviously fingerprints and stuff are like one of the best ways to identify people. And they obviously that didn't lead to anything.
Obviously whoever did it wasn't already in the database.
Exactly. So remember when I was describing the way her body was found? The police had blood and seminal fluid, which they retrieved from the crime scene. But obviously this was in the 1980s, so it wasn't actually much use at the time because DNA testing wasn't the way it is now.
Yeah, there wasn't a whole lot you could do.
Exactly. So in 2006, which was 19 years after the murder of Dana, DNA technology was a lot more advanced than it would have been back in the 80s. And then that was the first time that the detectives tried to profile the DNA. And unfortunately, there was no match found at the time. So the combined DNA index system, also known as CODIS, if you like true crime, you might have heard about this before because it does play like a very vital role in a lot of like investigations and stuff. Basically what that is, it's a national database where DNA profiles are created and maintained by the FBI. CODIS includes information about missing persons, convicted offenders, and forensic samples from crime scenes. As the database is constantly being updated, failure to find a hit the first time doesn't necessarily mean that all is lost.
Yeah, if there's all that information in there, like you'd have to really go digging.
Yeah, and also it's constantly being updated. So even if like somebody could commit like a petty crime, and that's how a lot of these cold cases end up getting solved. Like even the Netflix series, what's it called? I think it's called Cold Case Files.
Oh yeah.
That's really good. They refer to CODIS a lot and how basically a lot of them, like years and years later, like somebody could commit murders, like crazy bad shit.
Yeah.
And then they could get caught like robbing a store or something, and then they get their fingerprints taken, and then they get uploaded into CODIS, and then suddenly it's a match for all these other murders that happened years and years and years ago.
Yeah. It's great that they collected all of that evidence though and kept it
for so long.
Yeah, well, like in 1980, like they DNA probably weren't even thinking about
it. They didn't really know
how advanced it would have become in the future.
How it would help, but they still took it anyway. Yeah,
which obviously that's a big plus, where in this story we actually have detectives that gave a fuck and did something right, because so many cases as well, especially with things like this, they end up either like mishandling evidence or losing it or tampering with it in some shape or form where it's not really.
Yeah, some of them just don't do their jobs in general. Like the story that I'm going to talk about, like I just wanted to shake all of the policemen.
Yeah.
That dealt with it, because it's just like, why?
Yeah, and why do you always get those ones?
I know, it's all, I think I just don't like police. End of story.
Honestly though, I don't blame you, to be fair, because a lot of shit does end up going tits up because of how detectives or police handle certain cases, for sure. So, because of the fact that, you know, sometimes you don't always instantly get a hit with CODIS when it comes to like evidence and stuff, requests can be submitted like multiple times over the course of an investigation. So in Dana's case, a second attempt wasn't made until 6 years after that initial one back in 2006. So what would this be, 2012-ish? This time around though, there actually was a match. So the man who'd raped and murdered Dana Fader was a convicted rapist from Jackson, Mississippi, whose name was Rodney Clark.
No offense to anybody called Rodney Clark, but that sounds like a murderer's name.
Doesn't it?
Like, yeah. That
it actually does.
The vibes I get hearing that
just
name.
Just hear a Rodney Clark.
Yeah.
So the crime that had resulted in Rodney's incarceration had occurred in Mississippi in 1988, just months after the murder of Dana Fader. The victim was an 18-year-old that Rodney snatched from the street before violently sexually assaulting her. So you can tell that there's a bit of a pattern here. There's a bit of a trend. However, unlike Dana, that victim from 1988, the 18-year-old, actually ended up surviving her attack and then was able to point him out as her attacker. So that's how he ended up getting caught. So it was only because she managed to get away. Otherwise, I'm 100% sure that if he would have managed to kill that 18-year-old, this fella probably would have still been going around doing this for years after the fact. Here's where it gets a bit annoying. With that case, with that 18-year-old, he actually ended up entering a guilty plea. So he got like a plea deal at trial and he only got 8 years. Now, mind you as well, remember at this time, they didn't know that he was also responsible for Dana's.
Yeah.
So this was, look, that's just one sexual assault case, which I mean, even at that 8 years, I'm like, bro,
it should be a lot more than that.
Like, you should be fucking, is it sodomized? Is that the right word? Like,
castrated?
Oh, castrated. I was like, sodomized. I mean,
rapists should be castrated.
Sodomized is like doing to them what they did to...
Well, that as well. I mean, I stick by what I said. Both. Yeah, castrated, I mean, and like sodomized.
All of the above.
But yeah, so it was because of that. It was when he was convicted then for that attack that his DNA profile ended up in CODIS. So when he was brought in for questioning, Clark insisted that he had never lived in Florida apart from attending a job corp when he was 17. So that was obviously proven to be a lie. And then he admitted that he had lived in Palm Beach in the mid 80s and was still living there in 1987 when Dana was murdered. However, he still denied killing her. And when he was shown a picture of Dana, his reaction was hella fucking creepy, I think. Aww. Like, considering what had happened to her, his reaction when he was shown this photo, he said, "She's pretty, but I've never seen her before in my life." Which, I mean, like, why comment on her appearance?
Especially when you're already a fucking convicted rapist.
Yeah, and then it's like, oh, here's this woman that was brutally raped and murdered and we think it was you.
Yeah.
And he's like, "No, I didn't do that, but she is pretty, though."
Yeah. Like, it's kind of like going, "I didn't, but I would."
Exactly, yes. So despite the denials, Clark could not explain how his blood and semen ended up on the body of a murder victim. And I mean, like, even that itself, I'm like, how the fuck can you still deny it when they literally have your blood and semen?
Yeah.
From the crime scene.
Like, no, you're right. The real murderer fucking stole your blood and semen and planted
it there. And planted it there, yeah. Like, what the fuck? Anyways. He also wasn't able to explain how the palm print, which was now confirmed to be his because it matched his fingerprints, was on the rear window of the car which the body had been found. So the police were literally like, "Okay, we have this, this, and this on you. Like, explain this shit to me."
Bodily fluids in this car, on this body, like,
fingerprints, palm prints, the lot.
Yeah.
And he's just like, "Nah, didn't do it. Wasn't me." Luckily though, obviously the evidence was more than enough to fucking bring him in for what he did. And he was charged with first degree murder and extradited to Florida in 2013. When the case went to trial, Clark, ick of a man, continued to insist that the police had the wrong man. Like, the fucking audacity.
Like, the seriously, cheek. The actual fucking cheek.
Like, are you dumb, bro? Like, what do you mean?
"Yes, that's my DNA, but no, I wasn't there."
And this is what he said to a reporter about the whole instance. "They can have DNA. I ain't killed nobody. I don't give a damn what they got. I am innocent of any crime committed against Dana Fader." Sure, bro.
Sure.
If you fucking say so. He also insisted that he apparently looked forward to the trial and said that it was an opportunity for him to be able to clear his name. His public defender, Kerry, knew how damaging the DNA evidence was to this case and fought hard to have it thrown out, which I mean, kind of like, also, you're dumb too.
Like, I don't know how
he's people... like, I know my guy's guilty, so let's get rid of the thing that's making him guilty.
Yeah. But then it's like, you can't really just do that. You can't make that disappear. That's like substantial evidence right there. Like, that's not...
Like, I admire public defenders for getting, like, innocent people off the streets, but I don't know how you can knowingly defend
I don't understand
person.
That. Yeah.
I just don't get it.
I don't get that either.
I'd just be like, yeah, now, you did it.
I think a lot of the time... they don't want to know.
Yeah, a lot of the time they don't ask. They ask you not to tell them.
Yeah, because obviously it's a lot easier then, and morally it's a lot easier to just kind of look at the straight up facts rather than... But I mean, here the straight up facts fucking spoke for themselves.
Yeah.
So I don't know how this fella didn't know. Like, this fella definitely knew.
Yeah.
Anyways, if he would have succeeded to get rid of the DNA evidence, Kerry believed that Ronnie would have been let go as a free man. Luckily, though, the motion was denied, and... Rodney appeared for trial in 2017, and the prosecutor was determined to send him to death row, which, I mean, I don't really...
I agree
with that, yeah. I was like, I don't really blame him. Clark was convicted of first-degree murder, and Dr. Jethro Toomer had appeared as an expert witness in the trials of Florida's two most notorious killers, Ted Bundy and Eileen Wuornos.
But it's funny that you said Ted Bundy, because, like, I was literally saying, I was watching that Ted Bundy thing, and he was like, oh, I have faith in the public defense system. I know that, like, I'll clear my name. And he was all, like, cocky and
the
stuff.
Arrogance for me.
Yeah, I'm getting the same vibes from Clark.
Okay, so the same fella, so Dr. Jethro Toomer, also appeared at Rodney Clark's trial to argue that he did not deserve to die. So his whole argument was that Clark had suffered... I know as I keep switching between Rodney and Clark, it's the same dude, right? I have issues. I can't tell a story to save my life, but however. Yeah, so anyway, so his whole argument was that Rodney had suffered horrendous abuse as a child and felt that that should be taken into mitigation. The jury did agree, and I don't know, it's believed that they swayed by the fact that Clark, at the time of the trial, was disabled and had to be wheeled into the courtroom each day in a wheelchair. So obviously that's a bit of a sympathy card, I think.
Yeah.
That obviously played a factor in it, otherwise he probably would have got that role. But he didn't, he evaded it. And instead was sentenced to life in prison with no possibility of parole. Which, I mean, I still think that's justice.
Yeah, at least he's
going
to die in prison.
Exactly. So obviously Dana Fader's family finally managed to get some closure. 30 years had passed since Dana's murder had taken place. Obviously, that's like a hell of a lot of time. Like, imagine that, like, just not knowing.
Yeah.
But finally, the case was able to get closed.
Yeah.
That's insane. Like, when you think about that, her oldest child was 10 when she was murdered, and they were 42 when the case was closed. Like, that's a whole lifetime.
Literally a whole lifetime.
I would not be able to live like that. Like, if somebody... was murdered, somebody close to me was murdered, it would be devastating, but I don't think I could cope with not knowing what happened to them or who did it. Like, that would destroy you.
Yeah.
So the next story that we're going to talk about is about a little boy called James Wilfred Trotter. So James, aka Jamie, was a blonde 13-year-old described by his older brother Jeff as outgoing and friendly. Basically, Jamie was one of those kids who could make a friend in a room on his own.
That's such a nice way to describe someone. Yeah.
My little brother, my mommy say that about my little brother, so I stole it from her. I can't take credit.
That's so cute. I love it.
Yeah. So on April 19th, 1979, that sociable nature would get him into trouble.
Oh no.
Jamie got off a school bus near his home in Costa Mesa, I hope I'm saying that right, in California, and was never seen again. Within hours of his disappearance, Jamie was reported missing, but the police were slow to respond and pretty lax when they did eventually take action. They believed that Jamie had run away, and nothing that his mom, Barbara, could say would convince them otherwise. So
I hate shit like that.
I know, this is what I mean. Like, why? he's a kid, like,
yeah,
even if he ran away, like, he needs to come home. He needs to
come home. He's 13.
Yeah, kid.
You don't just let them fucking run amok and just leave.
Just see you later, like, no. So due to their negligence, basically, the case went cold. After 11 years of his family suffering through a Jamie-less life, a pile of charred bones were found by a hiker on a trail west of Lake Elsinore. I don't know. Apologies. Riverside County deputies responded to the scene and were able to confirm that the bones were human remains. Later, though, the medical examiner formed the opinion that they were from a young female and that they had been out in the open for at least a decade. That gave investigators a time frame to work with, but they found no missing persons cases within that time frame that matched the criteria, and there was no unsolved homicide to link to the remains. The bones ended up packed into an evidence locker where they would stay for another 6 years. So in 1996, detectives finally decided to take another look at the case, and the bones ended up getting re-examined. I'm guessing they requested it because he went missing around the same time.
Yeah.
This time the pathologist like formed a different opinion, and he concluded that the remains were not female after all, but they belonged to a prepubescent male.
Oh my god. And that was how long after?
6 years after the remains were found. And they were found 11 years.
For 11 years. So 17 years.
Whoa. 17 years. Like, that shit could have been determined from the beginning if your man wasn't like, oh no, those are a female.
A female, yeah, like,
they just didn't even consider Jamie.
No. Which is weird because there was literally no other cases that it could have been. So, like,
surely
it was worthwhile.
That's when it would have triggered something in them to go, wait, hold on, let me just double check this,
yeah. There was also something the original examination had missed, and the teeth still lodged into the jawbone showed evidence of dental work, and it was by that method that they were able to identify Jamie Trotter.
Wow.
So again, dental records.
Yeah.
That were just ignored.
Pre-DNA and that, it was all dental records if you found bones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
It just doesn't make sense. But this would not be an easy case to solve. 17 years had passed since Jamie stepped off the school bus, and any evidence that might have been left at the dump site had long since dissipated. There was no indication of where Jamie had been killed or even how he had died. All that police could do was start with the hiker who had found Jamie's bones. This man's name was James Crummell, so they had the same name, so I'm just going to refer to him as Crummell from now on.
Okay.
And the police were about to discover that he wasn't just some outdoor enthusiast who'd had the misfortune of stumbling upon human remains, like, just randomly.
Oh.
So it turned out that Crummell actually had a really dark past. He was born in Kalamazoo. I was about to say Kalamalazoo. He was born in Kalamazoo, Michigan in 1944. He was raised by what he described as a domineering mother who had wanted a daughter. She insisted on him dressing as a girl throughout his childhood.
What the fuck?
Yeah. So, I don't know. Have you seen, I think it's the second Insidious film?
Yeah.
That, I probably have, but
that's what it reminds me of. I should have looked up if it was, like, based on this. I don't think that it was, but
Still, that's
creepy.
Yeah. Mm. That's weird.
So, Crummell had been really close to his father, James Crummell Sr.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Everybody's called James, like, I swear to God.
It was a very popular name at the time.
Crummell Sr. had died in a motorcycle accident when the boy was 14. 2 years later, his mother remarried, and Crummell developed a strained relationship with his stepfather. On one occasion, the police were even called when James threatened to kill his stepfather with a meat cleaver.
Shit.
Yeah. A short time after the incident, he left home for good and enlisted in the army when he was 17. It was while serving in the military that Crummell committed his first known offense while stationed in Missouri, 1962. So he had lured two boys aged 13 and 11 into the woods, and he tied them to a tree and raped them. Crummell warned his victims not to say anything, but the boys reported the attack At the trial, a psychologist testified that Crummell had the mental age of an 8-year-old. That assessment kept him out of jail, but his military career was over. The next known offence that was committed by Crummell was in 1967 on the outskirts of Tucson, Arizona. Crummell lived in a mobile home there with his partner Steve
Scheimer.
I'm guessing.
It's only one M, so yeah, it'd be Scheimer.
Scheimer. With his partner Steve Scheimer. Living close by was an 8-year-old named Frank Clausen.
Oh my god, I can already see where this is going.
Yeah. February of that year, Frank was out on his bicycle and was visiting a friend, but never came home. A search was launched and he was actually found the next morning. Big trigger warning. He had been tossed into a ditch with his pants down and his belt pulled tightly around his neck. The autopsy showed that he had been strangled and sodomized.
I actually have no words. I'm like horrified right now. It's
disgusting.
That is fucking sick. I don't give a fuck if your ma dressed you as a little girl growing up and you had a bad relationship with your fucking stepdad. That is no excuse to do this shit. I'm sorry, it's just no.
Like, he should have been, maybe if he had the mental age of an 8-year-old, close observation. Like, lock him up somewhere. Put him in a mental facility.
Exactly. He needed constant supervision,
So, days later, the police were canvassing the area and questioning residents. Crummell and Scheimer had actually just packed up their stuff and moved away.
Not sketchy at all.
So, I don't know, like, I couldn't find anywhere if Scheimer knew what Crummell was doing or if he was just going along with him when he was like, we need to pack up and leave, but they packed up and left.
And back then, like, the different states didn't speak to each other, so that's, you know, how a lot of crimes went
slipped through the cracks.
Unsolved,
because the different police departments didn't speak to each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They ended up in Wisconsin, where Crummell was soon attracting the attention of the authorities. So, like, he couldn't
help himself.
He just, like, never stopped. He'd literally get to the next state and just
start again.
Either that or he was just really fucking confident and he was like, I'm just gonna do what I want. I don't know.
But apparently isn't that a thing though? Like, the more they get away with it, the more confident and careless they get with their crimes.
I think that's how a lot of people get caught.
Mm-hmm.
End up getting caught. That was broken English.
Been a long day.
So in 1968, Crummell picked up a 14-year-old hitchhiker, drove him to a remote spot and sexually assaulted him. He then beat the boy with a tree branch until he was unconscious and he caused horrific injuries. Eventually, he just left him there, believing that the boy had died, but he actually survived and he crawled out of the ravine where he'd been dumped and managed to flag down a person, like, driving by.
Oh my god.
Injured and traumatized, he was unable to talk for 3 days. Which, like, I'm not surprised.
Blame him, no.
When he did eventually speak, he provided enough information to lead the police to Crummell. They arrested and charged him with sexual assault and attempted murder. But Crummell was only sentenced to 5 years in prison. Which is just disgusting.
What the fuck?
Like, disgusting.
How?
5 years is nothing.
This fella got away with so much. That is, like, that doesn't even come close to, like, one of the crimes he committed.
Let alone zero all justice.
Zero.
Literally.
So, he was out and all by 1973. He travelled to Southern California, and no other crimes were reported as far as police are aware. Like, nothing else happened, but you never know, people might
that's true,
not reported it. 6 years later, on April 19th 1979, something terrible happened, and that's when 13-year-old Jamie Trotter went missing right out of his neighborhood. It turns out, during a cold case investigation in 1996, Riverside County detectives discovered that Crummell lived down the street from Jamie and his family. But he was never connected to the investigation until he called the police and said, I found these human remains.
What the fuck? Well, I have so many questions.
Psychotic.
First of all, like, did he get bored?
I don't know.
Suddenly was all like, "Ooh, let's play a game."
That's
a lot of killers do insert themselves into the investigations to remove suspicion. If he's the one calling the police saying, "I found these bones,"
but then again, I mean, like, that shit went unnoticed for 6 years. Yeah. If he would have shut his mouth, it probably would have continued to go unnoticed. By him suddenly going
11 years.
I can't do maths. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like 11 years and then going to the police who had already like basically put that case aside down in a dark corner that, you know,
they don't intend on looking
maybe
at. Looking
it's
at
like
ever
a
again.
Way of like reliving the crime.
Could be.
That
actually
makes sense. Yeah. Weird and anyways.
Yeah, it's creepy.
And also, fuck the police. Like, how do they not realise that shit?
It's 6 years after the 11 years.
That's what I mean. Like, how was that? Like, he already had been convicted at that point. He already had, like, a criminal history.
Yeah.
And they just never decided to even question him or, you know, consider him.
Down the street.
Yeah.
Like,
I know it's been 6 years or whatever since he was last reported of committing a crime, but I mean, I really don't think...
Both...
He just sat still for 6 years. No. I think he definitely did a lot more than any of us will ever fucking know.
Yeah.
And like both the crime he got convicted of was a 14-year-old boy. Jamie's a 13-year-old boy. Like
same kind of age. Yeah.
So as investigators looked further into Crummell's past, they started to suspect that he might be a serial killer.
I mean, look, better late than never, I suppose.
But it was a tricky situation because Crummell seemed to have a knack for avoiding the consequences of his actions. In 1982, Arizona prosecutors thought that they'd had enough evidence to nail him for the murder of Frank Clausen. They even extradited him from California to stand trial. But Steve Scheimer, who he was no longer with at that time, retracted his statement and the whole case fell apart. So Crummell was set free, but soon got into trouble again when he was caught molesting a 9-year-old.
Oh my god. A friend's
9-year-old son.
Oh my god.
He was eventually found not guilty of that charge, but served 200 days for failing to register as a sex offender.
I actually just can't.
No.
He just keeps getting released. Like, oh no.
I can't with this
keep
case.
Letting him go.
And like, he clearly he doesn't proves. Give a fuck. He keeps doing the same shit over and over and over again.
He proves every time that.
Like, there's no
he's
excuse.
Not gonna stop.
There's no excuse for him to just be
walking the streets.
Yeah.
So, in February 1983, Arizona made another attempt at the Clausen case and secured a murder conviction. However, it was overturned on appeal due to inadequate representation. Crummell ended up making a deal with Pima County prosecutors, pleading down to kidnapping and accepting a 3-year jail term.
Oh my god. Why was this offer even on the table?
Yeah.
They considering said it was murder and then they were like, actually no.
It's kids. How can you go from murder to kidnapping?
Yeah.
They're not even on the same plane.
So again, he was free in 1987. And in 1995, while living in Big Bear City, California, another young boy named Jack Phillips went missing. He was only 9. Crummell was living nearby, but somehow he managed to avoid being considered a suspect.
Haven't we seen this before?
Later on, he bragged to a cellmate about abducting, raping, and murdering the child.
Oh my god, he was literally going around fucking bragging.
Yeah.
Bragging.
He literally just admitted it, yeah. Finally, in June 2004, Crummell's luck ran out.
Finally. I've lost track of how many years.
I don't even know.
He was
too long.
79.
But he wasn't even the first.
He wasn't even the start. It started in 1962.
As far as they know, when he was when he was 17.
So
but who
like
knows?
42 years.
Yeah.
42 years. 40 fucking 2 years. This fella
was just getting away with it.
Just getting away with like molesting and murdering.
Oh
kids.
My god. See, I can't do math, so like my brain was like thinking maybe 20, but 42. No.
42 years.
He was eventually convicted of the murder of James Trotter and he was sentenced to death. Thank God.
After doing that for 42 years.
And the fella's in his like 60s at this point.
Yeah.
So it's not even
44,
like
44, I think it said.
Yeah.
So he's like literally 60.
So he tried to make a deal with prosecutors by offering to reveal the location of Jack Phillips's body in exchange for a life sentence, but the state of California refused. He was sent to San Quentin to await execution, and given California's history of executions, he might have stayed there indefinitely. However, on May 27, 2012, James Crummell hanged himself in his cell.
This is actually so infuriating.
Yeah.
What a coward.
If you guys could literally see our faces right now.
So fucking disappointing.
I hope he got treated like shit. I hope every day he spent...
To be honest.
In fucking prison, even, I hope like, he got abused.
You know, I'd even say he did. Criminals have a code, and it's like you don't mess with kids.
Yeah.
So if you're known to have messed with kids...
They get...
Yeah.
Bad treatment.
Yeah.
Good. Even by guards.
That's probably why he ended up just hanging himself, because he was like, oh, why give them the satisfaction?
Yeah.
And my life here is a nightmare anyways, rather than owning up to his shit.
Yeah.
So
I'm preying on kids as well. Like, I'm sorry. That's just...
They're defenseless.
I know.
So he was definitely a serial killer. But that's not the end of it. He's also the prime suspect in the April 1979 disappearance of 7-year-old Charles Christopher Francis in Santa Ana, California. He's also been linked to the disappearances of two teenagers from CEDU, Therapeutic Boarding School in Running Springs, California in the mid-90s, while he worked there as a youth counselor.
The dude is supposed to be a registered sex offender.
Why is he even allowed?
Why is he a youth counsellor?
Oh my god.
Neither of those boys have ever been found.
That is after sending me on a spiral.
I swear. That's fucked.
Okay, so the next one we're going to look at is Donald Morris. So in 1977, 41-year-old Donald Morris went to visit his parents in Florida, where he met his wife, Judith. Donald was recently divorced at the time and was quite lonely. Judith was a 2-time divorcee. Her children had been taken from her care because she was unable to support them. Now that she had met and married Donald, she was able to get her children back. Shortly after Judith moved into Donald's mobile home in Vernon Township, Ohio, she was joined by her sons Christopher Stiles, 5, John Stiles, 6, and Edward Stiles, 9. Though Donald Morris now had not only a wife but a family, he was still unhappy. Judith was an argumentative woman, and Donald's stubborn nature meant the couple would constantly have arguments. In some cases, their disagreements even turned into violence. Well, that might have something to do with the unhappiness then.
Yeah. Like, that explains the unhappiness.
That explains a lot.
Yeah. Maybe you needed to learn the yes, dear, and just not be so stubborn.
Yeah.
We'll see. So Donald realised that he had made a terrible mistake and decided that he needed to divorce from Judith, as their marriage had turned toxic. So she'd be 3-time divorced.
Yeah, she's going for a world record here.
Yeah.
I can kind of understand the other two and why.
Yeah. On the night of January 3rd, 1978, Donald's trailer had caught fire. The report of the fire on Orangeville Kinsman Road came into Berghill Vernon Fire Department at 12:35 that morning. Firefighters rushed to the location, but there was little they could do, as at this stage the fire was already out of control. It eventually required reinforcements from 4 local fire departments to put it out.
So that fire was like blazing.
Big fire.
And it's a trailer as well, mind you. It's not.
And also, like in America, everything seems to be like made out of wood.
That's true.
You know. I know a trailer, anyway, regardless of where you are, is going to be more flammable than a house.
Yeah.
But still.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
I feel like homes are very disposable.
Yeah.
Over there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems any time a house catches fire, it just burns to the ground.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't really get it.
I think it's because it's like, oh, it's cheap to rebuild. It's like, yeah, but you wouldn't have to rebuild it if you built it solid enough that it'd stay.
Like, there was that really bad fire at Belcombe College, and like majority it was mainly the roof that was gone, but the majority of the walls and stuff like still stood. Some of the like floorboards and shit were like caved in, but
the
outside the structure was like almost like intact,
timber, but the walls remain.
Yeah.
Anywho, that's enough of me bitching about American architecture. So anyway, once the fire was eventually put out, the remains of Donald Morris and 5-year-old Christopher Stiles were retrieved. They had both died in separate rooms. The other three residents of the house, Judith Morris and her sons Edward and John, had escaped. The boys had second-degree burns and were suffering from effects of smoke inhalation. Judith was the only one who remains perfectly unharmed. I wonder where this is going. They were all taken to the local hospital for treatment. At the hospital, detectives questioned Judith about the fire. According to Judith, she'd woken to the smell of something burning and noticed smoke seeping under her bedroom door. She woke her husband and they exited into the hall. There they encountered a wall of flame blocking their way out through the living room. Turning right, they moved towards the back of the house and exited through the back door. Donald then threw her outside and went back in, presumably to save the children. In the next moment, her son John came flying into her arms. Judith then said she ran next door to wake Donald's nephew, Gary, who had rushed to the house to help. He dragged 9-year-old Edward to safety. He then tried to go back in, but the fire was so intense that he couldn't. Donald Morris and Christopher Stiles was left still trapped inside. The Trumbull County Sheriff's Department found Judith's explanation for the fire suspicious. Judith said she believed the fire was caused by the furnace exploding. If that was the case, why hadn't everyone in the house been awakened? And why had none of the neighbours heard anything? Evidence showed that the fire had started in several different places throughout the home, rather than in a single location. The next thing that didn't make sense was what Judith was wearing. According to her, she'd been asleep in bed when the fire started, but when the first responders arrived, she was fully dressed.
Oh, for fuck's sake. Literally, like, how did they not cop that?
If you're gonna burn your gaff down in the middle of the night, put your jammies on.
Judith's behaviour was also questioned. Paramedics reported that she'd been laughing in the ambulance on the way to the hospital, which is obviously strange considering the woman just lost her husband and youngest son in a tragic fire. Each of these factors raised red flags with investigators. Another thing that didn't quite add up was that investigators found that Donald Morris's ear had been severed.
Jesus.
Injury isn't something that is common with victims in house fires. And as we said earlier, the arguments had led to violence.
Yep.
How did this case go cold? It should have been closed like the day.
Yeah. It's like anyone with half a brain cell can tell what's happened.
Put the story together.
Yeah. Although, you know, we never know. There might be a twist. We'll see.
There might be.
We'll see. So, as if the severed ear itself wasn't weird enough, the severed ear was actually found a short distance from the trailer and was not burnt at all. So she, like, Van Gogh'd that shit by the sound.
And it just launched it out the window.
Chop off the ear, okay. So, despite all these inconsistencies, the coroner ruled the deaths accidental. And the fire chief determined that the cause of the fires was due to the furnace exploding.
What?
What the hell?
That just makes... I can't...
See, I said, girls, there'd be a twist. the twist is always incompetent.
Coroners and fucking investigators. Wait, this time, what was it? The fire chief or something? Or who was it?
Fire chief and the coroner.
Yeah.
So,
there's always idiots in the story.
Yeah. So, with that, the case was closed. Judith Morris buried her husband and son, and by the end of that year, she had already moved on with her life and married husband number 4.
Oh my god.
And I can't. Just, you know, sleep about a bit. Like, you don't have to marry
everyone.
Like,
I told you, she's going for a world record here.
How many marriages can she get in?
Like, is this woman like the Black Widow or something? I was literally talking about doing like, us doing an episode of Women That Kill the Husband. She's on a run here.
Yeah.
I think she's going to be top of the list. Anywho, so D'Annunzio?
I know, what a name.
Had been a sheriff's deputy at the time of the fatal fire and had worked on the case as an investigator. He'd always believed that there was more to the case than what Judith Morris was letting on. Well, no fucking dirt.
Smart him. At least he was clued in.
Someone had half a brain cell. Okay.
Literally.
In 1993, D'Annunzio...
You can just call him Dan if it's easier.
Yeah. Dan the man was promoted to lieutenant and... It was at this time that he decided to reopen the case of Donald Morris. Began by tracking down the survivors of the fire. His initial efforts focused on Edward Bridge, the oldest of Judith's sons. Edward was incarcerated in Pennsylvania at the time, where he was serving a jail term for rape.
Jesus.
The apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
Yeah. When questioned about the events that happened on the day of the fire, Edward recalled that his mother and stepfather had been arguing that day, and Donald kept accusing Judith of cheating on him. Well, she moved on to wife
number...
Husband number four, very quickly, so it wouldn't surprise me.
Nope.
That night, Judith put her sons to bed after forcing them... to each swallow 4 teaspoons of cough syrup.
What the fuck?
She's trying to kill off all her kids by the sounds of things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This, according to a medical expert who testified at the trial, would have been enough to induce sleep in the youngsters. It had knocked out Edward Bridge initially, but Edward woke up a few hours later needing to go to the bathroom. When he left his room, he said he could still hear his mother and stepfather arguing. As he passed by their bedroom, he said he saw Donald slap his mother. Then his mum picked something up and hit Donald on the head, knocking him to the floor. As he lay there, Judith left the room and ran down to the kitchen. When she returned, she was holding a knife. Edward saw her re-enter the room, where she proceeded to stab Donald multiple times in the back.
Jesus. What the fuck is wrong with this woman?
I know.
She's like a psycho.
There's a thing called divorce, love.
Yeah.
Surely she'd know all about that.
You would think. Well, you never know what happened to the previous ones.
Yeah, that's true.
After this, Bridge claimed he saw his mother pouring something into the furnace. Even with Edward's statement, it was not enough to convict Judith for Donald's murder. Given the information came from a convicted rapist who'd been just 9 years old at the time, and by his own admission, doped with cough syrup. However, it was enough to obtain an exhumation order on the bodies of Donald Morris and Christopher Stiles. Those bodies had now been 15 years in the ground and were badly decomposed. When re-examined, it was found that 4 of Donald's ribs were sliced through and 1 of his vertebrae had been nicked. These were injuries consistent with a knife being plunged with considerable force into his back. There was also evidence that he had bled profusely before he died.
That is horrific.
Oh my god, traumatizing.
Yeah. With this new forensic evidence, coupled with Edward Bridges' testimony, prosecutors were able to obtain a grand jury indictment against Judith Morris. Now going by her married name, Delgross, and living in Sharon, Ohio, Judith was arrested at her workplace on March 22, 1993. She was charged with the murders of her former husband and 5-year-old son. During the trial, Edward Bridge testified for the prosecution and John Stiles spoke in his mother's defense, insisting that she was incapable of murder and had saved his life on that fateful night. As if this case wasn't insane enough, the trial took a bizarre turn when prosecutors suggested that Judith Delgross was a practicing witch.
Yeah, she's not wild.
Okay, and that witchcraft might have been the motive for the murders.
Okay, that's a new one.
I mean,
okay.
It took them so long to even fucking get started on this case. And then that's the best they can come up with.
Witch trials now. And might I just point out, witchcraft isn't dark and creepy like that. They're literally just women that celebrate Mother Earth and nature and spirituality. There's nothing like crazy about them. Donald Morris's severed ear was cited as evidence of this, but it is doubtful that the jury took these insinuations seriously. The murders had a far more logical explanation. Judith wanted to rid herself of a troublesome husband and of parental responsibilities at the same time.
This woman just wanted to press, reset.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, you can't do that. Why have all these kids and marry this person to just go, feeling it.
There are other options, you know?
Yeah, 100%. Sure, wait, hold on. Didn't the kids get bleeding taken away from her initially? And the only reason she managed to get them back?
Because she married him.
Why take them back then?
Yeah. Why go through the hassle if you're just going to kill them or try to kill them?
I know. What the fuck?
Yeah.
Something wasn't right with her.
So, if it wasn't for her son's late night bathroom break and the brave efforts of Gary Morris, she might well have succeeded. In the end, it all came down to the evidence. Donald Morris had undoubtedly been stabbed to death, and there was only one person who could have inflicted those injuries. Judith Delgross was ultimately convicted of 2 counts of murder and sentenced to life in prison. Parole was not ruled out and Delgross is now eligible, however. She was turned down at her first hearing in 2013. Now in her early 70s, she remains an inmate at the Ohio Reformatory for Women.
And I hope she stays there.
Literally, I was just about to say that. I was actually thinking the exact same thing.
Yeah, she's in her 70s now.
Just leave her there.
She may as well stay there.
Yeah, we don't want her room.
No.
Leave her there.
Definitely not.
Leave the men alone.
Yeah. Just leave everybody alone.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. That was fucked up.
This was a fucked up episode.
It was. I'm traumatised.
I'd kind of like to leave it on a happy note, though. Does everyone know Gypsy Rose is said to be released this December?
I meant to say that. Yes, I'm so happy for her.
I'm delighted for her.
100%.
And there's a lot of people that are like, oh, what's she going to do? But I'm like, you can't just leave her in prison when she doesn't deserve to be there.
Exactly. And her dad said that he'd support her, so she does have a support system there.
Yeah,
so.
I hope that he will get her the help that she needs. And yeah, I'm sure definitely. That it will work out for her.
100%.
Yeah, I'm really glad that she's getting out because she didn't deserve to be in there.
No.
Yeah. Well, yay for Gypsy Rose. I think we needed that at the end.
Yeah, 100%.
That was a bit of a tough episode today.
It was.
Yeah. You definitely go do some self-care.
Listening. We definitely will.
Unless you are literally sat there with a face mask on right now listening to this podcast, because I know some of us crazy bitches do that. We relax listening to true crime.
Yeah,
I do. 100%. But maybe not after this episode. I think I actually need something happy now.
Yeah, you might need to stick on a Disney film or something.
Yes.
Yeah, we apologise if you were just trying to chill out and we just came here.
And traumatised you. From a distance.
But if it helps, we're on the same boat. So
we're all in this together.
Yeah. But we hope you enjoyed it anyways. In the meantime, you can follow us on all of our socials. It's Insane Investigations Podcast. And don't forget to follow us on Spotify. And if you want to, you can also go to our Patreon. We are going to be putting some more stuff up there. Some hopefully Patreon only episodes and stuff. So go ahead and do that if you can.
Bye.